Why hadn't they brought such a sick old woman to him sooner? There was no point in explaining themselves.
Not cancer,
Teresa said to the Keatings when they came to tell her goodbye.
But it still looks like I'm going to have to spend the night.
She had a heart monitor now, an IV dripping into the back of her hand.
Lucky you,
Vic said. He was happy for her.
Oh,
Teresa said, touching her untethered hand to her forehead.
Cancer. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. They're giving me morphine now. I'm loopy.
Fix gave a little wave to say it meant nothing.
I'll come back later tonight and check on you,
Franny said. Teresa told her not to.
I talked to Albie. He'll be here first thing in the morning. I'm going to sleep straight through until then. To tell you the truth, I'm very tired. And anyway, you've come out here to be with your father, not me. I've eaten up half your day.
I just wish you could have had all of it, Caroline said. The second half was definitely better than the first.
We can wait here until you go to sleep,
Fix said, feeling both chivalrous and uncertain. He'd been in the wheelchair too long. He needed to get home and into his recliner. It had felt good to take someone else to the hospital for a change, to think of Teresa's condition rather than his own. But pain was only going to be ignored for so long. It had come back on him with a baseball bat.
I'm closing my eyes now. By the time you get to the door, I'll be asleep.
She smiled at Fix in his wheelchair, and then, true to her word, closed her eyes. She should have married Fix Keating. That's what she was thinking when sleep wrapped her up in its soft arms.
Fix Keating was a good man, but he was sick now, and she was sick. How was she going to be able to take care of him?
Caroline and Franny wheeled Fix down to the elevator. They were in a different part of the hospital now, having come in through the emergency room and then traveled to the other side of the world to get to the patient rooms. When they came outside, they were someplace they'd never seen before, and it took Caroline a while to find the car. By the time they got the wheelchair in the trunk and found the exit to the parking lot, Fix was asleep in the front seat, leaving Franny to put the address to the Santa Monica house into her phone. Neither Caroline nor Franny said anything for a long time. Maybe they were each waiting to be sure their father wasn't going to hear them. But why? What had they done? Fix's head fell back against the headrest. His mouth was open. If he hadn't been snoring very lightly, they might have wondered if he was dead.
When she said that about Cal turning white and then making a noise, Caroline said.
Franny nodded. Kumar's oldest son, Ravi, had asthma. There had been the summer at the lake in Wisconsin when she was clawing through his backpack trying to find the inhaler. The sound he was making was the sound Cal had made right before he died. That same high-pitched whistling that was, if not the opposite of breathing, at least the very end of breathing.
It's so hard to remember what I was thinking, Caroline said. Cal was already dead, but I still felt like I could do something about it. I could make sure no one knew we'd given Albie the Benadryl. I could get the gun back to the car.
Why did Cal have that goddamn gun?
Caroline said, turning to look at her. Who leaves a gun in a car and never knows their teenage son has it tied to his leg? And why did I care? Cal was dead, and the gun didn't have anything to do with it. It's like this enormous tree had just crashed through the house, and I was picking up leaves so no one would notice what had happened.
We were kids. We had no idea what we were doing.
I made it worse, Caroline said. Franny shook her head. You couldn't have made it worse. There isn't anything worse. She laid her forehead on the seat in front of her.
Maybe I should have told her.
Told her what?
I don't know. That Cal wasn't alone. That we were all there with him when he died.
Holly and Jeanette were there, too, and they never told her. Or who knows, maybe they did. We have no idea what Teresa knows about what happened in Virginia.
Unless she goes to the movies this weekend. Your guilt's got nothing on my guilt, Franny said. Your guilt isn't even in the ballpark.
Caroline and Franny lost their father's 83rd birthday. The traffic, which had been manageable driving over to Teresa's, was at a standstill going out to the beach from Torrance, and so they got home well after dark. The consequence of their kindness was that Fix had been too long in his wheelchair and too long in the car. His pain radiated out to his feet and hands and into the bones of his face, though it was nothing like the pain that concentrated into the white-hot center of himself.
"Just let me go to sleep," he said to Marjorie when they got him in the house. She had to bend over to hear him. He had so little voice left. "I can't stand this," he said. He was tugging at his shirt, trying to get it off.
Marjorie helped him with the buttons. During the course of his illness, Fix had lost his reserves. There was no buffer to carry him through the unexpected. They had stayed out too long, and now he was bone on bone.
"You're with Teresa Cousins?"
Marjorie said to Franny, in the same way she might have said, "You took him to South Central to smoke crack?"
"Her son called right after we got out of the movie. She had to go to the hospital," Franny said.
All she had to do was bring him home first. They were practically at the house when Albie called, but it hadn't occurred to her that she was the one to make that decision, not Fix.
"We didn't know it was going to take this long."
Caroline put a Loratab in a tiny spoonful of applesauce and gave it to her father. The pills were easier to swallow that way.
"Doesn't she have her own family?"
Marjorie had always been so patient with the girls, right from the beginning when Fix used to bring them over to her mother's house to take them swimming. But dragging their dying father along on an errand of mercy for someone they didn't know was tantamount to trying to kill him.
"She does," Franny said, "but none of them live in town. Dad said he wanted to see her."
"He didn't know her. Why would he want to see her?"
Marjorie ran her hands across the shoulders of his rumpled undershirt.
"I'll get you to bed," she told him.
Franny looked at her sister, the two of them still standing in the den once Marjorie had rolled Fix away.
"If there's anything else I can fuck up today, you let me know."
"It wasn't your fault,"
Caroline said and rubbed her face. Neither of them had eaten, and neither of them would.
"You didn't know. And anyway, we had to go, all three of us. We owed her that. I understand that it makes no sense to Marjorie, but even if it was a mistake, we owed it to Teresa."
Franny gave her sister a tired smile.
"Oh, my love," she said. "What do the only children do?"
"We'll never have to know," Caroline said.
Caroline went up to the bedroom they shared to call Wharton and say goodnight. Franny went into the backyard to call Kumar.
"Did you find the checkbook?" Franny asked.
"I did, but you could have texted me back 6 hours ago when I asked you."
"Really? I couldn't have," she yawned. "If you'd been here today, you'd be overwhelmed with sympathy for me right now. Did the boys make it home from soccer practice okay?"
"I haven't seen them," Kumar said.
"Don't give me a hard time. I'm not up for it."
"Ravi's in the shower. Amit is pretending to do his homework on the computer, but he switches over to some horrible video game whenever I stop watching him."
"Are you watching him now?" Franny asked.
"I am," her husband said.
Marjorie tapped on the kitchen window and waved her inside.
"I have to go now," Franny said.
"You're still coming back?"
"That's the one thing you don't have to worry about," she said, and hung up the phone.
"Your father wants you to come in and say goodnight," Marjorie said, looking tired. "I can't believe he's still awake."
"Is Caroline in there?"
Marjorie shook her head.
"He said he wanted to talk to you."
Franny promised not to keep him up.
Marjorie had pushed their two single beds together and covered them with a king-sized blanket and bedspread, to make it look like it was still one bed, even though Fix's side was a hospital bed. Sitting halfway up helped with the pain in his chest and made it easier for him to swallow his own saliva, so he slept that way. That was how Franny found him, in his light blue pajamas, staring at the ceiling.
Close the door, Fix said, and patted the space in the bed beside him. This is private.
Franny went and sat down next to her father. I'm sorry I dragged you out to Torrance, Franny said. I was thinking about Albie and Teresa when I should have been thinking about you.
Don't listen to Marjorie, Fix said.
Marjorie's looking out for you. That's why we had to go to Teresa's in the first place, because she doesn't have someone like Marjorie to take care of her.
Forget all about that for 2 minutes. We need to have a serious talk. Can you listen to me?
Fix in his bed seemed particularly hollow and small, her father's husk.
Bring the bed up a little more, he said,
and when Franny did, he said, good.
There. Now open the bedside table drawer.
It was a big drawer, deep and long and full of crossword puzzle books and envelopes, a paperback guide to the great hiking trails of California, a book of Kipling's poems, a pair of exercise grips to strengthen the hands, loose change, Vic's VapoRub, a rosary. The rosary surprised her. What am I looking for?
It's in the back.
Franny pulled the drawer out farther and shifted the papers around. There, she found the gun. She didn't have to ask. She took it out and held it in her lap.
Okay, she said.
Fix reached over and touched her hand. Then he put his hand on the gun and smiled.
Marjorie made me promise that I'd turn everything in when I retired. She said no more guns once we moved to the beach, so I didn't tell her.
Okay. Franny put her hand on top of her father's hand. She felt the delicate structure of his skeleton beneath his paper skin. She imagined it was like touching a bat's wing.
38, Smith & Wesson. This was my gun for a long, long time.
I remember, she said.
I never left the house without that gun.
Do you want me to take care of it for you? Franny wasn't exactly sure how she would do that. She couldn't put it in her luggage. She couldn't take it on the plane or bring it into her house in Chicago with Kumar and the boys. She didn't want the gun, but she was sure she could figure something out.
I can't pick it up anymore, he said. It's too heavy. I can't get it out of the drawer.
All the different things you think about, but I never thought about that. They would go down to the firing range at the police academy in the summer and shoot paper targets when she and Caroline were girls. It was, in all the world, the one thing Franny was better at than Caroline. She could shoot a gun. Fix's friends would come by and marvel at Franny's target paper when they pulled them in. Sign that girl up, the cops would say, and Franny, clear of eye and steady of hand, would beam.
Don't worry about that, Franny said. Could you shoot me, do you think?
Her father asked.
Your lore tab is kicking in, Dad. Go to sleep.
She took her father's hand off the gun, then leaned over and kissed his forehead.
It is kicking in, so you have to listen to me. There's no time for us to talk anymore, just the two of us. I can't pick up the gun, but no one knows that but you. No one would think of that. Lots of cops shoot themselves in the end. When the end comes to this, there's nothing wrong with it.
The gun lay heavy in her lap.
I'm not going to shoot you, Dad.
He looked at her then, his mouth open, and without his glasses she could see his eyes were fogged with cataracts. Was this the way Cal had looked at Teresa the summer he was 7, the bee crawling over his shirt? Was it the way Cal had looked at her when he died? She couldn't remember.
I need your help. Your help, Franny. Marjorie puts the pills away. I don't know where they are, and even if I did know, I couldn't get up to get them. I wouldn't know which ones to take. She fills up this feeding tube like I'm a car. If I shot myself, no one would mind.
Trust me. They would mind. I would mind.
Marjorie and Caroline will go to the grocery store tomorrow, and you'll stay here with me. Put on 2 pairs of those gloves, the disposable ones, one on top of the other. You put my hands on the gun, and then you hold your hands over my hands.
Franny put her hands over her father's hands. She couldn't write it off to the lore tab or the pain.
Dad, face the grip out.
Not to the throat, but away from the throat. Do you understand me? I'll be right here with you. We can go over it step by step.
You hold it right under my chin, then tilt it back just a little, maybe 20 degrees. Once you get it set up, I want you to lean back. You won't get hurt.
Why wasn't he asking Caroline?
That's what she wanted to know. Caroline was his favorite. She was the one he trusted. But Caroline wouldn't have listened to him.
I can't, she said.
When the gun fires, you'll drop it. Leave it, however it falls. You pull off the gloves and stick them in your pocket. Go look in the mirror, make sure there's nothing on your face, then call 911. That's all you've got to do. No one is ever going to think it was you.
And it won't be you. It's me.
It's you helping me. I wouldn't put you in a bad spot.
His eyes were closing, down and up and down.
It would be a bad spot, she said. There had always been the sensation of letting her father down, living with her mother, living on the other side of the country, living with Bert. How strange it was that even now all of that stayed with her, that she would think, even for an instant, of not shooting her father as failing him again.
People are scared of the wrong things, Fick said, his eyes closed. Cops are scared of the wrong things. We go around thinking what's going to get us is waiting on the other side of the door. It's outside, it's in the closet. But it isn't like that. What happened to Lomer, that's the anomaly. For the vast majority of the people on this planet, the thing that's going to kill them is already on the inside. You understand that, don't you, Franny?
I understand, she said. He reached out and patted her hand again, her hand and the gun.
I depend on you. So much, he said.
His mouth opened as if for one last thought, and then he fell asleep. Sitting on the edge of her father's bed, Franny unloaded the revolver. Unloading, cleaning, reloading, that was all part of their childhood education. There were 6 bullets in the chamber, and she put them in the front pocket of her jeans and stuck the gun in the back of her waistband beneath her shirt. Her pants were snug around the waist these days, and for once, she was glad about it. When she came back to the den, Caroline and Marjorie were watching the man who came to dinner. Caroline pushed the mute button while Monty Woolley tyrannized the secondary characters from his wheelchair.
"How's your father?" Marjorie asked.
"Asleep."
Franny could feel the cold of the metal pressing into the small of her back. It was ridiculous. Walking through the room with a gun and not mentioning it. But she didn't think the gun was anything Marjorie needed to know about, nor did she need to know about his request. She would tell Caroline in the morning, but there was nothing more that needed to be said tonight, not one more conversation. Franny said she was going to get into bed and read. That night, after putting the gun in her suitcase and the bullets in a sock, Franny dreamt of Holly. It had been so many years since they had seen each other, but there she was, still 14, her straight, dark hair divided into pigtails, her cropped yellow top knotted halfway up her skinny white torso. She was still a girl, freckles unfaded, braces on her teeth. They were back in Virginia, back at Bert's parents' house. And they were walking through the long field that lay between the house and the barn. Holly was talking, talking the way Holly was always talking, explaining the history of the Commonwealth and the Mattaponi Indians who had once lived along the banks of the river. The Mattaponi, she said, had fought the English in the Second and Third Anglo-Powhatan Wars.
Right here, she said, holding out her hands. There weren't many of them to begin with, and between the two wars and all the diseases the English brought with them, most of the Mattaponi died. Do you remember how Cal would look for arrowheads? Our grandfather had a dish of them on his desk, but he'd never give us any. He said he was saving them. What was he saving them for, do you think? An uprising?
Franny looked out over the green slope of grass. There was a shallow pond beyond the barn where the horses liked to wade on hot days, where they themselves had ventured in on some occasions despite the thick, sucking mud at the bottom. She looked at the distant line of trees that rimmed the field to the left and the stand of hay to the far right that the Cousinses leased out. She was trying to take in how beautiful it all was, the grass and the light and the trees, the entire valley. This was where Cal had died, where Holly and Caroline and Jeanette had run through the field once they realized what had happened, back to the house to get Ernestine, Caroline telling her to stay with Cal in case he needed help. Why had Caroline told her to stay?
"You took the gun then, remember?" Holly said. "You brought it back to Caroline later that night?"
Cal's eyes were shut, but his mouth was open like he was still trying to pull in air. His lips were thick and swollen, and his tongue was coming out of his mouth. Franny stood over him, looking back in the direction of the house and then looking down. When she remembered the gun, she pulled back his pants leg. There it was, stuffed in his sock and tied to his calf with a red bandana. Franny got it in her head that Ernestine or the Cousinses or whoever was coming out to save her shouldn't find the gun. They would all get in trouble for that.
"I don't know why I took it," she said. She really didn't.
Holly shook her head. "You couldn't have left it there. We were all so obsessed with the gun. It's all we ever thought about." Franny had untied the bandana and, carefully pointing the gun away from herself and away from Cal, unloaded it the way her father had taught her. She put the bullets in the front pocket of her shorts, holding the open revolver up to the light, spinning the cylinder, and looking down the barrel to the sun to make sure it was empty. She tied it up in the red cloth, but there was really no place to put it. She tried to put it in her waistband, but of course it showed. Finally, she decided to hide it behind a tree nearby. When everyone was gone, she would go back and get it and take it to the house. She would get Jeanette to come with her, and they would put the gun in Jeanette's purse. No one would think that was strange, because Jeanette always carried her purse. She remembered being glad to have something else to worry about, something other than Cal. Franny looked over at the barn.
"I always thought I did the wrong thing."
"What would the right thing have been?"
Holly put her arm around Franny's waist.
"We had no idea what was going on. We didn't even know he'd been stung by a bee."
"We didn't?"
"Not until later. We did that night when Dad came back from the hospital, but before we didn't have a clue."
"I loved it here," Franny said, though she had never known it before. Holly looked surprised.
"Did you? I hated this place."
Franny looked at her. Holly had been such a pretty girl. Why had she never noticed that? She thought of her as a sister now.
"Why did you come back then?"
"To make sure you were going to be okay," Holly said. "We always stuck together. Don't you remember that? We were such a fierce little tribe."
"Listen," Franny said, looking up. "Do you hear the birds?"
Holly shook her head.
"It's your phone. That's what I came to tell you. You shouldn't worry."
"About the birds?" Franny asked.
But then Holly was gone, and the room was dark again. She could still hear them.
"Answer your phone," Caroline said from the other bed.
The room was dark, except for the light of her phone. She picked it up, even though nothing good ever came from answering the phone in the middle of the night.
"Hello,"
Franny said.
"Mrs. Mehta?"
a voice said, a woman's voice.
"Yes?"
"This is Dr. Wilkinson. I'm calling from Torrance Memorial Medical Center. Mrs. Mehta, I'm sorry to tell you that your stepmother has passed away."
"Marjorie's dead?"
Franny sat straight up, the news pulling her awake. How was that possible? When had she gone to the hospital? Caroline got out of her bed and turned on the light on the table between them. There was only one person who was going to die, and that was their father.
"What?"
Caroline said. "Mrs. Cousins," the doctor said. Her heart monitor alerted the nurse a little after 4 o'clock this morning. We attempted resuscitation, but it was unsuccessful.
"Mrs. Cousins." Teresa died? Caroline said.
I'm sorry, the doctor said again. She was very sick.
Wait a minute, Franny said. I don't think I'm understanding what you're saying. Could you say this to my sister?
Franny gave the phone to Caroline. Caroline would know what questions to ask. The digital clock on the bedside table said it was 4:47 in the morning. She wondered if Albie would be awake by now, if he had set his alarm. He was taking an early flight to Los Angeles to see his mother.
Chapter 8 6 months in advance of her retirement, Teresa bought herself a ticket to Switzerland to visit Holly at the Zen Center. She did it so she'd have something to look forward to. She wasn't sure about retiring so much as she feared becoming a doddering presence in the job she had loved for so long. Over time, she'd seen everyone come and go, rise and fall, and pack the contents of his or her desk into a box. Sooner or later, she'd have to do the same. And wouldn't it be better to do it before they started nudging her towards the door? At 72, she might well have the time to figure out another life. Not that she was sure what that meant, exactly. She thought she might take a bridge class, or do a better job with her yard. She'd thought that she could go to Switzerland. 2 weeks after her retirement party, a pretty gold watch on her wrist and a ticket in her purse, she called a taxi for the airport. Holly didn't come home anymore. When she first went to Switzerland 25 years ago, she had planned to be gone for a month. She came back after 6 months, and then it was only to apply for a permanent visa. She officially quit her job at the Sumitomo Bank, which they had held for her. Holly had been an economics major at Berkeley, and even though she was young, she'd been valued at her job. She gave up the lease on her apartment, which had been sitting empty all this time. She sold her furniture.
Are you in love? Her mother asked.
She didn't actually think that Holly was in love, even though she exhibited all the classic signs. Distraction and dewiness, a loss of appetite. Holly had cut her dark hair close to her head. Her face was scrubbed. And for the first time in years, Teresa could see that a smattering of freckles still remained. Teresa was afraid her oldest daughter had been kidnapped. Even though they were sitting together at the kitchen table drinking coffee, that her brain had been taken over by a cult that had allowed her body to come home long enough to sort out her possessions, throwing everyone off the trail. But asking Holly if she'd been taken over by a cult was a harder question.
Not in love, Holly said, picking up her mother's hand and squeezing it. Not exactly.
It used to be that Holly came home from time to time, first once a year, then every two or three. Teresa suspected that Bert bought the tickets, but she never asked. After a while, the small trickle of occasional visits dried up. Holly said she didn't want to come back to the States anymore, making it sound like it was her country she was letting go of rather than her family. She said she was happier in Switzerland. While Teresa ardently wished for her children's happiness, she didn't understand why they couldn't have found it closer to Torrance. With one of them gone, the other three might have chosen to circle the wagons. But it seemed just the opposite had happened, that Cal's death had flung each of them to their own far corner. She missed them all, but mostly she missed Holly. Holly was the least mysterious of her children, the only one who on occasion would crawl into her bed at night, saying she wanted to talk.
You could always come see me, Holly would write whenever her mother complained, first in slow aerogram letters and then, blessedly, in emails, once the Zen Center, called Zen Dojo Tozan, got its own computer.
Teresa never could remember the actual name of the place, so it helped to see it printed out.
What would I do in Switzerland? Her mother wrote back. Sit with me. Holly wrote.
It wasn't so much to ask. Certainly, she'd sat with Jeanette and Fode and the boys in Brooklyn. She'd sat with Albie in any number of places, including her own living room. Over the long years, Teresa had gotten past her suspicion of Buddhism and meditation. Holly, the time she'd seen her, had still been Holly. And while there had been plenty of good reasons not to go when she was working, without work, all she could tell herself was that she was too old, the trip too long, the tickets too expensive, and the connections too intimidating. None of those were reason enough to miss seeing her own daughter. The flight from Los Angeles to Paris was 12 hours. Teresa accepted the free wine whenever the cart rolled down the narrow aisle, slept fitfully against the window, and tried to read the English patient. By the time the plane landed at Charles de Gaulle, she had aged 20 years. Prosecutors should insist the trials of murderers and drug lords be held in economy class on crowded transatlantic flights, where any suspect would confess to any crime in exchange for the promise of a soft bed in a dark, quiet room. Off the plane, stiff and slow, she shuffled into the river of life, the roll-aboard suitcases trailing behind the cell phone talkers like obedient dogs, everyone walking with such assurance that it never occurred to her not to follow them. She was too muddled to think for herself. Yet, when she finally did, snapped back to reality by the sight of an information desk, she was told that her departure gate was in another terminal that could be accessed by shuttle bus, and that the flight to Lucerne was 3 hours delayed. Teresa accepted a highlighted map of the airport from the startlingly handsome informational Frenchman and started making her way back in the direction from whence she came. Her feet had swollen on the flight and were now a full size larger than the shoes she was wearing. It wasn't that she expected someone was going to show up and escort her to the gate, but she couldn't help but remember the way things had gone the last time she was in this airport, 50 years ago. She was a different person under considerably different circumstances. Bert had taken Teresa to Paris for their honeymoon. It was all a surprise. He made the hotel reservations, ordered francs from the bank, asked Teresa's mother to pack her daughter's suitcase. His parents drove them to Dulles the morning after the wedding to catch their flight, and she still didn't know where they were going. She had majored in French literature at the University of Virginia and had never left the country. She had never spoken French outside of class. She stopped at a little café on the concourse, collapsed into the white molded plastic chair, and ordered a café au lait and a croissant. That was easy enough. She had nothing but time. She eased her heels out of the backs of her shoes, even though she knew it was a mistake. Her feet would expand like bread dough, and she would never be able to cram them back in. For the first time since she was in her 20s, she thought about what a beautiful boy Bert Cousins had been. Tall and sandy blonde, with such dark blue eyes they startled her every morning when he opened them. His family was rich as Croesus, her grandmother liked to say. His parents had given him a little green Fiat when he graduated from college. When they met, he was in his second year of law school at UVA, the top of his class, and she was in her senior year of college. She slipped on a patch of ice one snowy January morning hurrying to class and had gone down hard, books and papers fanning out around her, the icy air knocked from her lungs. She was lying on her back, too stunned for the moment to do anything but watch the flakes of snow wafting towards her. When Bert Cousins leaned into her view and asked if she would allow him to help her. Yes, she would. He picked her up, a stranger, picked her up in his arms and carried her all the way to the infirmary, missing his next class to wait while they wrapped her ankle. A year later, when he asked her to marry him, he told her that he wanted to move them to California after he finished law school. He would take the California bar, and they would start a whole new life together where nobody knew them. He wasn't going to spend his days drawing up contracts for real estate sales. He was going to practice real law. And he wanted children, he said. Lots and lots of children. As an only child, he had wished for nothing but brothers and sisters. Teresa looked back and forth between Bert and the pretty ring on her hand, and thought, she must be emitting light from her entire body. She loved him so much. It was unnerving to remember that now, at 72, spreading strawberry jam on the tip of her croissant, how much she had loved him. She could barely hold the thought in her mind. She had loved Bert Cousins, and then grown used to him, then was disappointed in him, and then later, after he left her with four small children, she had hated him with the full force of her life. But in the Charles de Gaulle airport when she was 22, her love for him had precluded all thoughts of ever not loving him. They held hands on the way to baggage claim, and while they waited beside the shining silver luggage chute, he kissed her, full and deep, not giving a thought to who might be watching, because they were married. They were in Paris. Teresa looked at all the people walking past her table at the airport coffee shop and wondered how many of them were starting their honeymoons and how many of them were in love and how many of them would not be in love later on. The truth was, she had more or less forgotten about Bert. It took a long time, but it was a fact that now entire years would pass when she failed to ask the children how their father was, because she simply didn't think of him. She had lived long enough that Bert and all the love and rage he had engendered were gone. Cal was still with her. Jim Chen was there. But Bert, alive and well in Virginia, was gone. Revived by the coffee and the rest, Teresa stuffed her feet painfully back in her shoes and beat a slow path to her gate. Maybe she would stay in Switzerland forever. Maybe she would become a Buddhist. She couldn't imagine doing this again. Holly had neglected to go into the tiny room that had once been a broom closet beneath the kitchen stairs to check the computer for the status of her mother's flight from Paris. It was only now that she was at the airport in Lucerne, standing in front of the arrival board, that she could see the plane was 3 hours late. True, she didn't have occasion to go to the airport very often, but what kind of idiot forgets to check the time before making an hour-long drive? Because it was a rule that whoever took the car also had to take the phone, she was able to send a text to Mikhail and explain the situation. She knew he wouldn't care. He told her they didn't need the car, but still, she felt like she was inconveniencing the community by keeping it for so long. Assuming that the time now listed was, in fact, correct, they would not be returning until after 2 o'clock. She had told her mother to take the train from Paris. No one flew from Paris to Lucerne. The train was a snap. But her mother had despaired at the thought of taking a train from the airport to the Gare de Lyon and then finding the train to Lucerne. And maybe it would have been impossible with the jet lag and the luggage. Holly could have taken the train up and met her in Paris, but she never suggested that. She didn't want to be away that long. Holly had completed her morning kitchen work early, washing and peeling 10 pounds of potatoes, cutting them into chunks, and leaving them covered in cold, salted water, while at every moment striving to remain present in her task. She had gone to the guest room where her mother would be sleeping to make sure there were towels and a washcloth beside the basin, and a bottle of water and a glass beside the bed. She excused herself for morning meditation early, stepping around the cushions of others as quietly as possible to leave for the airport. Though, of course, now she realized she hadn't had to do that at all. She could have stayed. Her sense of irritation with herself was so ridiculously disproportionate to the event that she had to wonder if the problem wasn't really that she didn't want her mother to visit. While she understood the importance of letting all thoughts rise without judgment, to see them and to let them go, she decided it would probably be best just to squelch this one. Holly bought a Toblerone bar at the news kiosk and then looked around the waiting area for discarded newspapers, as chocolate and news were the two things her life was lacking. And sex. Sex was lacking, but she had enough sense not to look for that in the airport. She found copies of Le Matin, Blick, but she didn't do so well reading German. And wonder of wonders, a complete Tuesday edition of the New York Times. Suddenly, she was soothed. The idea of spending 3 hours in the airport with three newspapers and Toblerone was nothing short of a miracle. She peeled back the tinfoil and broke off a piece of candy, resting it on her tongue to melt before she read the science section of the Times. Tasmanian devils were dying of oral cancer. There was reason to think it might be better to run without running shoes, and children living in poverty in the inner cities were as likely to suffer from asthma as children in war zones. She tried to figure out what she was supposed to do with the information. How could she save the devils, get them to stop biting one another, which appeared to be how the cancer was spread? And why was she worrying about a small, vicious marsupial in Tasmania, and feeling next to nothing about the asthmatic children? Why had she read the entire article about running when she wasn't a runner, but skipped the piece about geothermal energy? Exactly how shallow had she become? She folded the paper in her lap and sat with the information for a moment. She thought that she should leave Zen Dojo Tozan more often, or maybe leave it altogether. And she thought that she should never leave it under any circumstances, like Siobhan, whom Holly had never seen go farther than the mailbox at the end of the driveway. When Holly remembered her life in California, she remembered seeing everything in terms of who had less than she did and who had more. Who was prettier, smarter, who had a better relationship, everyone, usually. Who was getting promoted faster, because as much as they had praised her at the bank, there seemed to be people they preferred. She was constantly trying to figure out how to do it better, how to get it right, and in doing so, she had started to grind her teeth at night. She had chewed a soft crater on the inside of her left cheek and was picking at the cuticles of her thumbs until they bled. She made an appointment with an internist, told him her problems, and then showed him the inside of her mouth. He peered around her tongue and teeth with a penlight, looked at her hands, and then suggested meditation. Or that's what she thought he had said. You're going to need meditation. The instant she heard the word, she felt her heart surge, as if her heart had been waiting for this exact moment. Finally, her heart said to her, at last! Where can I learn to meditate? She asked. Just the word in her mouth brought forth joy. The doctor looked at her as if wondering how crazy she might be. Medication, he said again, slower and louder this time. You'll need medication for your anxiety. I'm going to write you a prescription for Ativan. We'll work with the dosage. We'll have to figure out what's right for you. But Holly dropped the white slip of paper in the trash can after giving the receptionist a 20 for her copay. However unwittingly, the doctor had told her how she would be cured. She didn't even understand exactly what meditation entailed at that point, but she knew she was going to find out. She read a couple of books, listened to some Dharma talks on cassette tapes in her car, and then found a group that sat on Wednesday nights and Saturday mornings. She started a sitting practice at home, getting up early before she went to the bank in the morning. 6 months later, some people from the Wednesday group invited her along for a weekend retreat. Later, she sat in silence for a week at the Spirituality Center just north of Berkeley. It was there she saw a notice on the corkboard about Zen Dojo Tozan. She felt the same acceleration in her heart that she had felt when she first misunderstood her doctor. There I am, she thought, looking at the picture of the chalet balanced on a soft sweep of mountain flowers. She pulled the pushpin from the brochure and let it drop into her hand. Things like this happened to Holly. At times, she had a sense of being guided, and when she did, she attributed it to Cal. For years after Cal died, Holly was rocked with regret that they hadn't been closer, and there was regret about other things as well. But since coming to Switzerland, she'd started to see that for a 15-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl in a stressful living situation, they'd done pretty well. They yelled at one another, but carried no grudges. They shoved, but never slapped or pinched. They threw couch pillows at one another, not dishes, Holly corrected Cal's homework without condescension, and Cal, in the shining memory of her childhood, had once yanked two girls off of her in the hallway at school, one by her ponytail and the other by her shirt collar, as they were attempting to stuff Holly into her locker.
"You bitches get off my sister,"
he had said as the bitches stumbled backwards and then ran down the hall in tears. He had hurt them, scared them senseless. Holly, who made it her business to look after everyone, was for that one golden moment protected by her brother. As the two oldest children, Holly and Cal worked together to look after Albie and Jeanette, keeping them away from the stove and the knives when they were younger. And they looked after their mother, too. Maybe not in tandem, but they made an effort to lighten her load, to keep things from her whenever possible. The more Holly felt Cal's presence in her life now, the more she knew he cared for her, that he forgave her. The better job she did at keeping her life quiet, her eyes open to the simple beauty that surrounded her, the better she was able to hear him. She didn't hear him in any nutty way. They didn't sit around and talk politics. It was more a pleasant feeling, easy enough to achieve at Zen Dojo Tozan. But she could even do it here, in the waiting area of the Lucerne Airport. She believed that most of the human population didn't avail themselves to their full psychic potential. They lived in a state of mental clutter, the bombardment of goods and services, information and striving. They wouldn't be able to recognize true happiness if it were standing on their foot. It had been almost impossible to hear her brother when she was at Berkeley, at the Sumitomo Bank, or anywhere in Los Angeles. But in Switzerland, this place where he had never been, well, it was better. Holly went back to her newspapers. She read about Broadway plays. She read a book review and an op-ed about flooding in Iowa. She read about the plight of women in Afghanistan. She finished half her chocolate and put the other half in her purse for later. Seeing the time, she got up and went to stand with the families and the drivers holding hand-lettered signs when she saw Teresa walking towards her. So tiny, so much older. How long had it been now? 10 years? More than that? She was flooded with love. Such a huge wave, both her love and her brother's. She held out her arms. "Oh, Mom," Holly said. Where to begin with the marvels? First, of course, was Holly, who, with her cropped black hair touched in gray and her Birkenstocks and woolly socks, was radiant. All those people packed together on the other side of security. All those people making a single, indistinguishable mass, and then, bam, Holly. She was something else entirely. No one could have missed her. When Teresa fell into her embrace, it was as if they had never been parted. She had such an overwhelming memory of the nurse coming into her room the morning Holly was born, laying that perfect baby in her arms, the baby who was now this beautiful woman. Teresa kissed her neck, pressed her cheek to her daughter's sternum. "I'm sorry you had to wait so long," she said, not knowing if she meant the 3-hour delay or all the years it had taken her to get there. "I had a nice time," Holly said, running her hand across her mother's head. She took the carry-on and her purse, slung them over her shoulder like they were nothing, like she could have just as easily slung Teresa over her shoulder, too. She walked her straight to the restroom without asking if she had to go, and she did. This was the person Holly had always been, in charge, making decisions, being helpful without being asked. When Teresa pointed out her luggage at the baggage claim, Holly scooped it up and laughed. "You pack like a Californian," she said, thrilled by such a small thing. "I do, too."
"How do Californians pack?"
Teresa was laughing without getting the joke, her smile so wide she felt certain she was showing teeth that had not been seen in years. Holly held up her mother's black wheelie bag. It was small and discreet, a footnote to all the giant, bright pink hard sides reinforced with bungee cords that circled before them.
Europeans pack like they're never coming home. I think it has to do with the war.
Outside, the air was bright and cold despite it being the 1st of September. It had been 96 degrees when she left Los Angeles. Holly helped her on with her coat. Teresa was proud of herself for having brought the coat in the first place. At home in her living room, she had put it on and then taken it off, locked the front door, gone to the taxi, gone back inside and put the coat on again. She could see the Alps in the distance from the parking lot now. She had seen them from the plane, the snow-covered peaks. Alps. She pulled the coat tighter. Who would have thought Teresa Cousins would ever see the Alps? The Zen Dojo Tozan Citroën that Holly drove was more like a soup can than a car. The flimsy metal shuddered as she downshifted around the curves, the gear shift a long stick coming up from the floorboard. Back home on the 405, such a car would be crushed by the blowback from a passing SUV. But on this perilous mountain road, it felt like all the other tin cans. They could bump into one another without significant harm, like people brushing past on a crowded street. No one had upped the ante in order to save themselves, built a daily tank that would obliterate the competition. They were all in this together. The guardrail that separated them from the vertiginous drop off the side of the mountain seemed similarly unprepared to save a life. But what difference did it make? They were all going to die anyway, all of them. They weren't even at the Zen Center, whatever it was called, and already Teresa felt she was getting the point. Who needed airbags? The reinforced steel cage construction that created a barrier to the world. Teresa rolled down her window, rolled it down with a hand crank, and breathed in the bright Swiss air.
"So beautiful," she said.
They shot into a stone tunnel cut through the side of the mountain. Light, then darkness, then pine trees.
"Just you wait," her daughter said.
"I have to tell you, Holly, I didn't understand until now. I mean, I've been happy for you, but in the back of my mind I was always thinking, what's wrong with Torrance?"
They drove past two shaggy mountain goats on the side of the road, their curled horns looking like crowns. No doubt they were waiting for Heidi and Grandfather to herd them back into the mountains. Teresa looked over at Holly.
"Why would anyone live in Torrance?"
"There's nothing wrong with home," Holly said, feeling so pleased to receive her mother's affirmation. "But it's quieter here. It's better for me."
"I think about Jeanette in Brooklyn with Fode and the boys. I think she likes all the noise, her tight little space. I think that's what holds her together. And Albie, always picking up and going someplace else, always looking for something new. That probably works for him. He's in New Orleans now."
"He emails me sometimes," Holly said,
feeling such a sudden longing for her brother and sister, wanting them all to sit together in the same room with their mother.
"That's good.
What about you?"
"What about me?"
Teresa said, craning around to catch another glimpse of the view that receded behind them.
"Has staying in Torrance been good for you? Was it the right choice?"
They were driving through a forest now. The trees, their lower trunks furred with moss, got thicker and taller and started to cut into the light while ferns stretched across the forest floor. There were enormous rocks, boulders really, that looked like they'd been placed by set designers around a fast-running stream.
"Show me an enchanted forest," the producer must have said.
"Your father wanted me to move all of us to Virginia when he left with Beverly so we'd be close by. I didn't even consider it, to tell you the truth. Maybe I should have. It would have made things easier on you kids. I just couldn't find it in myself to be that accommodating."
"That's the stupidest thing I ever heard," Holly said, foolishly taking her eyes off the road for a second to stare at her mother. "I never knew he said that."
"Then, after Cal died," Teresa shrugged. "Well, you remember that. We sure weren't moving to Virginia after Cal died, though I'll tell you, it bothered me to have him buried there. It was just about going forward in those days. One step, not falling all the way down into myself. I didn't think about changing my life. My life had already been changed. I just had to get through it.
You got through it. Holly took the car down to second. They were behind a truck, climbing and climbing.
We all did, I guess, in our own ways. You don't think you're going to, but then you do. You're still alive. That was the thing that caught me in the end. I was still alive. You and Albie and Jeanette, still alive. And we wouldn't be forever. So I had to do something with that.
Teresa put her hand over Holly's hand, felt the deep rattle of the gear shift.
Listen to me, talking. I never talk like this.
It's Switzerland. That's what it does to people. Holly stopped to reconsider. I should say that's what it's done to me. Actually, most of the people I've met here are pretty quiet. Teresa smiled and nodded.
Well, it's good. I like it.
Zen Dojo Tozan was not in Zarnen or Thun, but somewhere between the two. Not in a village, but in the tall grass and blue flowers. It occupied a large chalet that was built high into the slope of a mountain. The chalet had been the country home of a banker from Zurich. In the summer, he and his wife swam with their 5 children in the lake, and in the winter they skied, and in between, unbeknownst to anyone in Zarnen or Thun or Zurich, they sat together on Zafu cushions, all 7 of them, and closed their eyes and cleared their minds as surely as the bracing mountain air had cleared their lungs. The house was left with a trust to form Zen Dojo Tozan, with the understanding that the family's children and their children and all of the children to come would be welcome. Katrina, the 4th daughter, now in her 70s, lived there full-time in the small back bedroom she had slept in as a child. Along with Katrina, there were 14 other full-time residents. Twice a year, they hosted retreats, running a rented shuttle bus back and forth from the inn in Thun. But most of their income came from walking sticks. All of the residents participated in some way in the carving or distribution of the sticks, either the art or the business, they like to say. The sticks were highly sought after, especially by American and Australian meditators who knew that they would never make it to Switzerland. Holly, who displayed no talent with wood or knives, did the accounting. She had found there was virtually no ceiling on what could be charged for a long pole of Swiss stone pine with a carved fish for a handle. Drop a 5-euro compass into the fish's back and double the price, even though no one seemed to understand the basic tenets of orienteering anymore. They bought the wood from a mill in Lausanne, and while they could have had a cheaper and more compelling stock from Germany, they had made the decision to keep the sticks Swiss. That's what it said on their website. Swiss walking sticks carved from Swiss stone pine by meditators in Switzerland. Every day after meditation and community chores, a few hours were devoted to the sticks. Paul whittled the wood into sticks. Lelia blocked out the crude bodies of the fish with a carving knife. And then Hyla began the delicate work of scales. These sticks, along with their modest endowment, kept up the roof and paid the taxes and put cheese and bread on the table. They had a wait list of 8 months for walking sticks. The wait list for residences had gotten too long to be useful and was stuck in a desk drawer and forgotten.
"We're lucky there's a guest room open," Holly said, taking her mother's hand as she walked her up the wooden steps. Her mother, steady enough, would benefit from a stick. The wind could knock a person over some days. People come as a guest for a month, and then they refuse to leave. There are 3 guest rooms, and the schedule is always messed up. People just stay and stay. They think one of us is going to leave and make a space for them. The chalet was ringed by a wide wooden porch that jutted out over the crystalline world. Heavy wooden chairs, hewn by a careless axe,
were spread around so that a disciple might rest while taking in the view. The Alps looked like a drawing of the Alps on a candy wrapper, an idealized version meant to draw strangers in. Teresa had to stop and catch her breath, from the view, the thinner air, from the fact that she had actually done it and was there.
"It worked for you," she said, huffing slightly.
Holly stood there, seeing it all again through her mother's eyes.
"Well, someone actually died while I was waiting them out. That's when I came back to California and quit my job. He was a Frenchman named Philippe. The walking sticks had been Philippe's idea years before when they were running out of money and worried they'd have to give the place up. He was a sweet old bird. I still have his room."
"Do other people's mothers come?"
Teresa asked, trying not to sound competitive but feeling exactly that. She was so proud of herself.
"Sometimes. Less than you'd think."
As soon as she saw the bed in her room, Teresa took a nap. Then, before dinner and the Dharma talk and the last sitting of the day, Holly did her best to give her mother a crash course in meditation. Breathing in and out, following the breath, letting the thoughts come up and pass away without judgment.
"You just have to do it," she said finally, fearing her explanation was doing more harm than good.
"It's pretty straightforward." So Teresa, wearing the tracksuit she wore in the mornings when she did her power walk with her neighbor, sat down on a cushion beside her daughter and closed her eyes.
Nothing much happened at first. She thought about the ache in her left knee. Then there was the thought that the other people seemed nice. She liked Mikhail, the Russian who she called Michael. Did he run the place? Very welcoming, all of them with their hair cut short like Holly's. And why not? What difference did it make? There was no one to impress. She could see that Holly was happy here. But was it a real life? And what would she do when she was Teresa's age? Would they take care of her? She could ask the older woman, the one who'd grown up in this house. Imagine, this place is a house, a home for a single family. How many servants must they have had to keep this up? Both of her feet were asleep. She caught herself then. Such babble! Teresa was shocked by the roaming idleness of her mind, as if she were sifting through trash on the side of the freeway and was stopped, enchanted by every foil gum wrapper. She came back for a single breath, but found herself reflecting on the bean salad they'd had for dinner. Some kind of pink beans in there she hadn't seen since childhood. She couldn't remember what they were called. Her mother would ask her to pick through the beans before she soaked them to look for little rocks, and she would be so meticulous until she lost interest, dumping the unchecked beans on top of the ones she had vetted, ruining everything. Did anyone in her family ever bite down on a rock? One breath? She couldn't manage that. Maybe a single inhalation that wasn't burdened by thought? She tried. There. Okay,